Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Yesterday, MU football player Michael Sam publicly came out as gay in interviews with several media outlets. There's been, of course, a lot of reaction to the news, with many praising the defensive lineman's decision and others questioning whether it'll affect his prospects of being drafted into the NFL. Sam would be the first openly gay player in the NFL if he is drafted. Before his announcement, he was projected to be taken in the third or fourth round. Today on Intersection, we're breaking format just slightly to talk about this developing story. Later on in the show, though, we'll talk about the implications of Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. But for now, joining me to talk about Michael Sam's announcement is Jim Buzinski. He's a co-founder of OutSports. That's a sports website which helped break the story. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so yeah, just to start, just give us a little bit of context. This is a beat you cover very regularly about what this announcement means.
It's significantly, probably the most significant gay sports story in American history. Michael Sam would be the first openly gay NFL player if he got drafted by a team. We've never had that. We've never had that in any of the other four sports. Jason Collins came out in the NBA, but he was near the end of his career and had not yet even set foot on the court. So if Sam plays, he would be the first, and so it would be the biggest story in gay sports history.
Sure. And as we mentioned there in the intro, OutSports has been very involved with Michael Sam throughout this process of making this announcement. What have the conversations been like behind the scenes with Michael and those around him?
Well, this all got accelerated. Michael wanted to come out probably right before the draft in May, but the feeling was that it had to come out sooner than that so he can get ready for the combine and then his pro day at Missouri. He wanted to make it a non-distraction and sort of give people 3 months so they can kind of process it. So, and then there was some other media pressures that the story was going to be broken by some others. So it ran last night on the New York Times, ESPN, and OutSports.
Yeah, and there had been, it's been widely reported that it was a relatively open secret locally anyway, and it was something that had gotten around a little bit where word was spreading to these news agencies, right? So it was kind of just getting ahead of it from what I understand.
Yes.
Yeah, and so yeah, and we mentioned as well, many have been speculating. Sports Illustrated, in fact, shortly after the announcement today, released an article talking about how this might affect Michael Sam's prospects and his career. What have you been hearing about that, and what are your thoughts on that, I guess?
Well, so far all we've seen are anonymous quotes by these people afraid to use their name, claiming it'll be a distraction, it'll hurt his draft stock. Nobody knows. There's a lot of pre-draft posturing that goes on every year among all sorts of prospects. This is a different wrinkle. I would think the NFL is so competitive that anybody who wants to win, if they think Michael Sam will help them win, it'll not be a deterrent to them. And if someone doesn't draft him because he's gay, I think that's a team that's kind of clueless and out of touch with what kind of today's modern NFL is.
Sure. And has Michael Sam said anything about that particular aspect of that? I mean, I'm sure it's something he's considered. His professional.
Yeah, he really said he's not worried about it. He said the chips will fall where they will, and he's comfortable making his decision.
Right. Is it different in the NFL than maybe any other professional sports? I mean, it's been a wide discussion on this issue for a couple of years now. What is the NFL different than, you know, basketball or baseball, other professional sports?
All four sports are the same in the sense that it's still very hard for a person feeling to come out because of all the sort of all images of the macho culture in the locker room and all that stuff. Football is the biggest sport, so in some ways people were surprised. They thought maybe pro hockey would be the first because it's not as kind of popular. But I think the locker room culture is the same in kind of all these. You have a lot of teammates and team bonding. And so the stereotype has been, well, these people can't fit in. Well, Michael was open on the MU team all last season. His whole team knew. So he had a great season. They had a great season. So in terms of the team chemistry, it only enhanced it.
Yeah, and again, some of the reporting has said that, you know, leading up to the draft this year, some NFL franchises, it was believed, likely knew about this information as well, since it had been, you know, known by some people.
They clearly knew. I mean, I think any team that drafted him, even if Michael didn't come out in the media, they would have known because everyone in Missouri knew. It was not even a secret. He was out.
Right, right. Another interesting thing about, again, this discussion's been happening, especially in the NFL, for quite some time now. There was some speculation last year that a number of active NFL players may come out together publicly as a group. That didn't ever happen. Do you think this might lead to something like that happening sometime in the future?
Probably unlikely. I think coming out's a very personal process for every individual. I think it may cause some people to rethink it, but I don't think you're going to see a flood because everybody has their own reasons for coming out or not coming out.
Yeah. What do you think about Michael doing it at this point where he doesn't have a career yet solidified? You know, comparing it to, again, those people that may have already had jobs and been stars or whatever.
I think it's going to be actually easier because the team that drafts him knows it's getting an openly gay player. There's not going to be a secret. There's not going to be a surprise. They can't say, oh, this is, you know, we didn't know this or it's a distraction. They're going to know what they're getting into. So I think he handled it the proper way because as soon as he steps on the field, he'll be known as openly gay and there won't be this dramatic, you know, mid-career announcement.
To that point, do you think there may be certain teams? What type of team may draft him if they are going to draft him?
I think hopefully, first off, a team that needs him for his talent. There are several organizations that are very pro-gay friendly owners and coaches who are very strong leaders. It will take a strong management thing because if there are any player problems, they're going to come on and nip those in the bud. And you're going to want a team that kind of has leadership that says, listen, we're all about winning. We don't care about this other stuff.
Sure. It had been reported by OutSports that there was a party over the weekend with some athletes who had come out after they had retired and also some supporters from the NFL currently or most very recently. I understand you were at that party as well. What was that like meeting with Michael and in that setting?
It was a very informal dinner at his publicist house, the guy who was helping him come out, Howard Bragman. Michael was very relaxed, very at ease, very fun just to talk to. He just said, you know, he's less nervous than other people around him who think this is a big deal. This is for him. It's to him, it's just he knows the importance of it, but it's not a big deal for him personally. He's very comfortable doing this. And you'd have to be pretty strong and comfortable to knowing that you're going to get this kind of media attention. He's not naive, but he just came across as very relaxed, and I can see why he'd be a fun teammate. He's a really kind of a guy you kind of warm to. If you talk to him, he's just somebody you kind of like. He makes you smile, and I think that's what kind of, you know, people look for, a teammate that's fun to have around in addition to being a good player.
Sure. And who else was at that dinner party?
It was Wade Davis, former NFL player who's gay, Dave Coppé, the first openly gay NFL player. I mean, all these guys came out after they retired. Brendan Iambadejo and Chris Cluey, two former NFL players who are straight but very good allies. Billy Bean, the first major league professional player who was gay. And it was kind of a sign to sort of, hey, listen, these are brothers in sports, and they were there to show support and let him know that he's not alone as he starts his journey.
What do you think about the Missouri team? Again, you mentioned they knew at the beginning of this season because Michael had confided in them to tell them this about him, about himself. What do you think about the fact that he was able to make it through this season, again, with all the speculation about what this might mean for an NFL team?
Well, he actually told us Saturday that he had played better because he was out. He wasn't having to hide anymore. The coaching staff was great. Players were great. I mean, Michael led the SEC in sacks. And all they cared about is how he performed in the field. So he had nothing but high praise for his coaches and the way Missouri handled it and his team. So I think kind of, you know, it's a good day for the University of Missouri. I mean, you know, they come across looking great on this. This was, you know, more progressive than, you know, a lot of schools you would, you know, maybe on the coast that you would think might be a little more gay friendly. But it was in Mizzou that he was able to be himself.
What do you think about the public reaction to this news so far? Again, it's broken in the last, really, I guess, you know, 16, 17 hours. But what do you think about the public reaction so far?
It's been pretty much overwhelming. The anonymous quotes have been that anonymous quotes from general managers worrying about how he'll place. But the public reaction, at least from the gay community, is overwhelming support. And, you know, the player's reaction hasn't been that much yet. But it's been, you know, listen, if he can play, he can play. And I think that's the bottom line, that we want Michael to be judged about how he does on the field, not like who he sleeps with off it.
Sure. What do you think, though, I guess, about when the smoke clears, right, after this initial news comes out? And, you know, it's obviously probably be a story for the coming weeks as well. What is Michael going to face as that goes on?
Well, they're being very careful about not having Michael do a lot of media interviews. They don't want him to be talking about this nonstop because that way he'll distract from football. I think it'll be a story that'll ebb and flow, that the combine in 2 weeks will be big, and then the draft will be big in, you know, in May. And then if he's in training camp, it'll be a big story for a bit. But I think once he starts playing, people are going to get kind of tired of it because there'll be nothing new to report. I mean, unless there's some incident, he's just going to be another guy on a football team. He happens to be gay. We've written about it. We've talked about it. And now we move on to the next story.
Okay. All right, Jim, thank you very much. Thanks for all the time we're going to have with you today. But thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
All right. I've been speaking to Jim Buzinski. He's a co-founder of Outsports, a sports website that helped break the story as MU football player Michael Sam, who just finished his last season with the Mizzou Tigers, publicly came out as gay yesterday. Sam's been projected to be drafted into the NFL this year. So this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and now we're going to move on to our next topic today, Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. In his State of the State address last month, Governor Nixon pledged $20 million to train additional mental health professionals, pointing out that more than 90% of the state's counties are designated shortage areas. According to the governor, more than 60% lack even a licensed psychiatrist. Joining me in studio to discuss this today, Keith Schaefer is the director of the Missouri Department of Mental Health. Dr. Schaefer, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan.
Cindy Keel is the executive director of the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Cindy, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Brent McGinty is the president and CEO of the Missouri Coalition of Community Mental Health Centers. Brent, welcome to the show. And for you and our audience, what questions do you have about mental health care in Missouri? Send us your questions. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at @intersectkbia. And thanks all of you for sitting very patiently during that unusual first start to our show there. So I guess, to start, why don't we start with you, Keith Schaefer. When it comes to mental health, what kind of professionals is Missouri lacking in right now?
Well, you mentioned the psychiatrist, and clearly we are very, very short on psychiatry. In fact, the whole nation is very short on psychiatry, but we also are short on advanced nurse practitioners with psychiatric specialty. We're short on psychologists. We are short on just registered nurses. A rather new field is applied behavioral analysis, which focuses primarily on issues like autism, and we're extremely short in that area.
Okay. And so you mentioned that, you know, compared nationwide, some of these shortages are also an issue. Are there any that are particular issues in Missouri compared to other states?
No, we're pretty typical, actually.
Yeah.
And the governor, as you mentioned, has been around. I think nationally there's a projection that about 77% of all the U.S. counties are extremely short of mental health professionals. So it's pretty consistent with us.
So how many psychiatrists do we need? If we could say we need this many tomorrow, what would the number be? Can we say a number right now? Or what kind of range are we talking about?
We can nationally, probably more than in Missouri. But nationally, I think we have about, as I recall, we're about 30,000 psychiatrists short across the nation. Some people believe that's as high as 45,000 psychiatrists short. One of the problems we have is that a lot of the guys and ladies who are psychiatrists now are older, so they're going to be exiting the profession pretty soon, and a lot of the young people coming into the profession are not going into psychiatry. So we have a problem now, and it's going to get worse.
Sure. Yeah. What are there other reasons? What are some of the other reasons for the shortage, I guess, in some of these professionals?
Well, the nature of the job. I mean, you have to get an MD. You have to get an MD degree before you become a psychiatrist, and then you have to go into the specialty. And frankly, it's a little bit like primary care docs. The pay for psychiatry is certainly not nearly as high as if you went into surgery or med surg or some area like that. And it's the discipline is pretty demanding, and you work with difficult people. So it's just a hard combination of things.
Sure. And then another issue, I don't think I mentioned in the intro, but the amount of psychiatric hospital beds we have in the state. What's the situation of that currently?
Well, that's diminished pretty rapidly in the last few years. We've lost about 1,000 psychiatric beds for adults, actually in the last 10 years, and we're down to, just for adult acute psychiatry, we're down to probably about 1,170 of those beds. That's for the whole state of Missouri, so it's extremely short. Ironically, though, it's pretty short all across the country, and the number of beds really don't give you a perfect indication of what's happening, because if you have an extremely strong community-based system like for instance, Brent represents here, then you need fewer psychiatric beds. If you have an extremely weak community system, then quite often you rely more heavily on those beds.
Sure. And so, yeah, what are some of the areas, I guess, of the state that we have an issue? Are certain areas where it's worse than others?
Well, certainly the rural areas.
Yeah.
And I have a concern because our legislature has not expanded Medicaid. We have three bordering states that have done that, and I'm just concerned that our mental health professionals are going to be crossing the border to take jobs where they can make more money, have better places to work, better conditions, more customers. There are billing systems under Medicaid that can be accessed with the expansion, and our state has not done that. So I'm just very concerned that our situation, as bad as it is, might get worse.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, there are projections that if it's expanded, it'll create many jobs.
24,000 is the projection
right.
in the first year,
right.
That first year alone. I mean, it's so good that the Missouri Chamber of Commerce has come out to endorse the expansion.
Right. And so, so like you're saying, these other states that have expanded are adding those jobs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they're throwing out incentives for our professionals. It's not only our mental health professionals, but other health professionals. There's a huge nursing shortage in Missouri nationwide. It's really a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My providers certainly are in competition to try to recruit and retain these jobs, and we see in our newspapers across the state, especially around the border areas, where in the newspapers you're getting recruitment ads from other states trying to bring people in, and we are losing people to the VA system as well, Veterans Administration. So our providers are struggling with recruitment and retention in this environment.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned rural areas, Cindy. So do we think expansion of Medicaid would affect specifically rural areas quickly?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One aspect of the Medicaid expansion is that hospitals will be losing their disproportionate share money, which Keith can explain a lot more articulately than I can. But this is the money that hospitals are reimbursed for their charity care. Well, that money is going away to finance Medicaid expansion, and it's going to finance it in other states while patients in Missouri are going to be left uninsured.
If I'm not mistaken, they've been pushing that back a little bit. That was supposed to happen,
last year. Yes, there was some relief.
They've delayed it some. They've delayed it, but ultimately it's inevitably going to have to happen, and it's going to be a huge problem. Those rural hospitals who are brave enough to actually do behavioral health care, to have acute inpatient behavioral health programs, the dilemma you have is an awful lot of folks who are uninsured, indigent individuals, come to those programs. If you lose your disproportionate share, which is another term for indigent care reimbursement by the federal government, and you can't get that, you're going to close the wards in the units in your hospital where the greatest number of uninsured people are that you don't get reimbursed for. Mm-hmm. That, unfortunately, by far happens to be psychiatry.
Mm. Right. And so, is this something that will affect mental health more than physical health?
Yeah, it will. And I think people pretty much accept that. You know, we're down to 1,174 beds, lost 1,000 in the last 10 years. We could lose another 1,000 without batting an eye in the next 10 years or so, given what could be happening on disproportionate share.
And I think what we see on the ground is, and Keith knows this very well because he hears the same stories, but in rural areas where they used to be able to travel maybe a county or two counties over to find a bed for someone, our law enforcement community is really struggling with individuals in their county trying to find a bed and having have transportation now. We're hearing stories from northeast Missouri where now they're having to find a bed in Nevada, Missouri. You think about a rural county with two or three deputies perhaps, and all of a sudden you have to take one or two off line and travel all the way to Nevada, Missouri, to then wait in an ER for admittance and to get all that filed and completed and get that person taken care of and safe. That's a very difficult problem for these rural counties to be facing. And like Keith said, if it gets worse down the road, that problem's only going to get exacerbated, and we're going to continue to struggle both from a local law enforcement but also for these individuals and their families.
Right. If we take those disproportionate share funds and then we continue to have a huge number of people who are uninsured, this could put a number of these small rural hospitals at risk.
Right. So then we're talking about, again,
making it's already to the point where we don't have some of these professionals.
It's just, bad now. Yeah. It could get a whole lot worse.
Sure.
If something's not done fairly soon.
I want to take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuhlener, and today on Intersection, we're exploring the implications of Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. Joining me in studio, Keith Schaefer is the director of the Missouri Department of Mental Health. Cindy Keel is the executive director of the state chapter of the National Alliance of Mental Illness, and Brent McGinty is the president and CEO of the Missouri Coalition of Community Mental Health Centers. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Have you sought out mental health treatment in Missouri? What difficulties did you encounter when looking for a provider? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at InterSectKBIA. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at KBIA.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to KBIA.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at KBIA.org. So you mentioned, Keith Schaefer, that it may get worse. Things may get worse. What are some of the factors that will make things get worse? Is it a lack of state funding? We talked about some other things as well, but what could lie ahead that's concerning here?
Well, of course, the demographics that I talked to you about the aging of the professionals is a little bit scary, but Cindy hit the nail on the head. One of the biggest dangers is if we don't expand Medicaid, because we told you earlier that we have a tremendous shortage across this country in the critical professional positions, the psychiatry, the doctor, the nurses, et cetera, and the competition will get fierce for those people, for those states who are actually implementing the program. So we're going to see an erosion of our professionals. They're going to go for better paying jobs. They're going to go other places. There's no logic for them staying in the state of Missouri. That is probably the biggest threat that we're going to face now. Even if we don't have that threat, there's a huge absence of those professionals in the rural area. We're going to have to figure out new ways to do business. We can't just say, well, this is terrible. We should put out another 20 or 30 psychiatrists at MU, which has a good program, in the next 5 or 10 years, and that'll solve the problem. The problem is too big for that. It's going to take the kind of collaborative approach where physical health and behavioral health come together to basically treat individuals on an integrated fashion. Most people do not realize that if you have a serious persistent mental illness over your lifetime, you're likely to also have some extremely severe chronic physical disorders. In fact, 8 out of 10 people who die very early from these conditions will actually die from the physical condition, not the mental health condition.
And so is that something that other states have implemented, that kind of approach, I guess?
You know, interestingly, Ryan, we're probably this is one of those rare cases where we may be ahead of almost everybody else. Brent's system has begun to integrate physical and behavioral health care over the last 6 or 7 years. Missouri was considered the first state in the nation to receive some large federal grants to support this effort. So we're good at what we do at this stage of the game. We will fall back if we don't expand Medicaid and we don't figure out how to better integrate our systems.
Yeah. Brent, maybe it's a good time to talk a little bit. We haven't really said what your agency does. What tell us a little bit about the system you guys have set up.
Sure. My group represents 32 providers across the state. We're basically on the psychiatric side, the community mental health system, represent all the community mental health centers across the state of Missouri, plus a large proportion of the substance abuse providers across the state of Missouri. So we provide that comprehensive system of care for individuals suffering with severe mental illness and substance abuse issues. What Keith talked about, what we are very excited about and has an opportunity to really change the game in Missouri and puts us kind of as a national leader in the country, is our healthcare home initiative and our disease management initiatives, where we're really going out now and not being a passive provider, but we're engaging people to get them into care and then provide that not just the stabilization and treatment and recovery from their mental illness, but really looking at the physical side of things too. It's just not enough anymore to treat one side of that equation. Like Keith said, the folks with serious mental illness, according to a study by Dr. Parks and others of several years ago, indicated that our folks were dying 25 years earlier than the general population. And we just can't allow that to continue to happen. So we're very excited about it. And it's changing then what the mental health workforce is looking like. In the past, it might have been only psychiatrists and positions like that, psychologists, therapists. But what we're really competing with now is for RNs and, mm-hmm. and other positions like that, where we're really kind of focused on the whole person. So we do that in partnership, though, with a lot of our primary care friends. And so we like to think we're not necessarily in competition with them. It's a lot of partnerships and developing those systems of care for people with wraparound primary care services that are really kind of helping the system move forward.
And just to be clear, how are your mental health centers operated, funded, I guess, in relation to the state?
Yeah, we have various funding streams. DMH Medicaid is a significant one, but we bill Medicare, private pay insurance. Mm-hmm. We have private pay. We have any number of kind of payer systems, payer streams like other healthcare providers do. But it's no, it's obvious, though, Medicaid is one of our number one funder of service for this population in the state of Missouri.
Mm-hmm. So you guys also do a lot of charity care, tremendous amount of charity care, and that's a strain because they don't get reimbursed by the federal government in ways. For instance, if you're a hospital, you get reimbursed. But I have to give a plug to them. They've done a phenomenal job in reaching out to people and keeping people in very intensive services, and that's the only way we're going to improve the lives of those folks.
And so to get back to the Medicaid expansion idea, since Medicaid is a big part of your work, I mean, how would that affect what you guys are doing if it were expanded?
Yeah, it's a significant, it could be a significant impact, the single most. It could be transformative, really. We're talking about close to 50,000 people that could be impacted by this. A significant number of those, like Keith said, we attempt to have in care, but are limited by the amount of charity care we can provide or the amount of uninsured dollars. There's a very limited pot of uninsured dollars left available to us. So it could be transformative. Right now, for instance, our system's too crisis-driven. I think Cindy could probably attest to that.
You bet.
Like in the phone call she gets. Right. We try our best to get folks into service as soon as we can, but those resources are limited. And crisis driven, unfortunately. There's just the system now for Medicaid, it drives people to get full disability before they can get coverage out of Medicaid. Mm. So it's a system that encourages disability, and it should be about recovery. And if we could get people earlier in their mental illness and into treatment quicker and more timely, I think we could have a much more impactful, better outcome and get people into recovery, that process faster and more timely. It'd be good for everybody, and that's where we want to get to.
Cindy.
What's so frustrating is we know what it takes to help people recover. We have evidence-based programs. We have the technology. We know the kind of supports that you need to surround a person with. Even people who have some of the more serious mental illnesses, they certainly can do a lot better and recover. Mm-hmm. And NAMI's goal is to have a system in which recovery is the expected outcome. But it's not happening because of lack of resources. I know Brent and his group do a wonderful job, and I'm just bugging him all the time, referring people over to them for charity care. But he can only do so much.
Do you have an example of what that might look like for an individual with certain issues?
Yeah,
let me give an example of that,
because that's what your listener really needs to understand. If you're a parent and you have a 22-year-old kid, let's say a 19-year-old kid who's going to MU, and that child begins to experience first-break schizophrenia. Right. Which is an extremely devastating disease. It's a thought disorder, which means you will have hallucinations, you'll have delusions, etc. You will not do well in college. You will begin to be very, very disoriented. And if that parent realizes what's happening or is trying to find out what's happening and tries to seek help, that kid does not have insurance generally. That kid is certainly not Medicaid eligible. And the parent will reach out for somebody to help them, and they simply won't have anybody there.
Let's finish this thought. We're going to have to take a quick break, but let's finish that story right when we come back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We're exploring the implications of Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. Joining us in studio are Keith Schaefer, Cindy Keel, and Brent McGinty. I'm Ryan Femulin, and we'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today on Intersection, we're exploring the implications of Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. Joining me in studio, Keith Schaefer is the director of the Missouri Department of Mental Health. Cindy Keel is the executive director of the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Brent McGinty is the president and CEO of the Missouri Coalition of Community Mental Health Centers. And for you in our audience, are you a mental health professional? What challenges do you have in providing care? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. And so, yeah, Keith Schaefer, we had to interrupt you there right before we went to
Not
the break.
Problem.
But an example of a young person who may be experiencing their first break at around 18-25 and what, how
right.
that might go.
Yeah.
And the odds are pretty good that what will happen to you first is you'll wind up, if you're lucky, I suppose, you'll wind up in an emergency room and you will have your mental illness will be showing itself, and the emergency room won't know what to do, and they will be trying to find a bed for you to go into in a hospital or trying to get help in, of some kind. They will struggle with that. You may be in that emergency room for a long, long time. You might be lucky and wind up in one of Brent's facilities programs, and Brent will try to help. He'll try to provide as much crisis service as he can, but he can't provide the kind of intensive support on an ongoing basis that your kid needs because it simply costs too much and your kid's not Medicaid eligible. And your kid is going to fight his illness and not want to become Medicaid, not want to become labeled as disabled, and he's going to fight that for 8 or 10 years. If he's lucky and he lives that long and he doesn't wind up in jail or whatever, at that point he may, in effect, sort of give up and accept the disability, and then you can come into the intensive services of our programs. All backwards.
Mm-hmm.
We should be reaching these kids as early as we possibly can. We should be providing the most intensive services. A lot of these kids could do well in the community with that kind of help. They don't get it.
And so what are the barriers to getting earlier care?
It's all about the money. And the truth of the matter is, because of the way Medicaid is constructed and because we are so dependent on the Medicaid dollar as it now exists, that dollar doesn't kick in until the kid's 35, 40 years old. If you had Medicaid expansion and that child had an income of 138% of poverty or less, which is quite likely, that individual could begin those services almost immediately. And he'd need a lot of help for a period of time, but he could do well. He could come back to your college. He could succeed in life. But at this point in time, we simply have no funding stream for that kind of service.
And you've kind of alluded to it, but I think for the general audience, why is that 18 to 25 age group so important for mental health?
Yeah, actually, you did, and you were absolutely right. Because the very serious mental illnesses, like bipolar disorder, sometimes called manic depression in the old days, certainly the schizophrenias, they tend to begin to show themselves quite severely for young men between the ages of 18-25. For young women, a little bit older. But this is a young person's disease, young adult's disease, in its first manifestation.
Right. And so, again, go ahead, Cindy, go ahead.
And far too often, the family is just bumfuzzled. They have no idea what's going on. They think their kid has got involved with drugs or is running with a bad crowd, or they just don't understand what's going on. And then there's the stigma, the social stigma associated with these disorders. They don't want to think that their child has a mental illness. The person who's having the symptoms doesn't want to think, I am mentally ill. I mean, that's there are so many negative things associated with those words. So they don't get into treatment. Mm-hmm. And it's tragic. It's just tragic because, I mean, the difference is if they can get into treatment right away and get themselves stabilized and start to recover, they can have a future. They can have the kind of life that we all would want to have. But if they don't, this can mean a lifetime of disability. I mean, it's that crucial. If we can intervene, detect it early, get it treated and addressed early, and managed in the same way you might manage diabetes with lifestyle, education, and medication, that person has a future. But far too often, and in most cases, we don't get to get in there with treatment till too late.
Mm-hmm. And is that, again, there's probably many things involved, but is that just about the getting it paid for? Is it about access to a certain
professional? It's about getting it paid for. It's about access. I mean, people, I have seen in my organization, which I work with we're a nonprofit organization. We get calls from all over the state, from families mainly. And what we have seen is families that have every kind of connection in their community, have lots of money, have great insurance, even they can't get their kid in quickly when that kid needs treatment.
Just because it's too booked up because of the shortage.
Too booked up. There's a shortage. Healthcare providers, many aren't taking new patients. We've got a big problem in this state.
And you can imagine what that's like if you live in Licking, Missouri, where I grew up, versus St. Louis, Missouri. It's not the same kind of place. And Sydney's issue about stigma is still, unfortunately, very, very real in the state of Missouri. So people will tend not to seek treatment simply because they're incredibly embarrassed about something they don't understand and don't realize that they could actually fix in some good ways.
Yeah, I was just going to repeat, those issues are so connected, the payer and the capacity, because without the payer, we're relying on that limited pot of charity care. I think I saw my most recent number in St. Louis, it's about $2 million or more in charity care. So you can ramp up your capacity as good as you can, but at some point you just are at that capacity, and Medicaid expansion would let us then start to have that source that we could start to increase our capacity to get the recruitment and kind of ramped up a little bit. But it gets back to the shortage, and we do need to see something done on the supply side.
If I'm a professional, you know, I'm not going to be very excited about fixing you briefly and then you disappear from treatment and I never see you again and I go to the next crisis. That's not a good way to recruit professionals.
Right. And so again, we see, Brent, you probably, I'm guessing, have seen some of these examples of people who just haven't been able to find this care, right? I mean, what are some of the examples, I guess, of roadblocks a regular person may run into?
Yeah, we see that depending on what can happen if we lose a psychiatrist or a doc, or if we lose a professional clinician in any particular area, in a rural area, where we have providers that are stretched pretty thin and cover a really large geography. You know, losing staff like that, important staff, can be really devastating and create waits much longer than we would like. And it's so critical that you really need to avoid those waits if you can, because a lot can go wrong while you wait months to get into treatment.
They won't just sit around during that time.
No.
They will wind up over and over and over again in emergency rooms that are not prepared to handle them. Mm-hmm. They will wind up over and over and over again associated with the sheriff, the county sheriff, or others, because they are so disoriented and so delusional that they really won't know what's happening. It's not like these people just sit and wait. These people have huge problems while they're sitting and waiting.
Yeah, and it's a crisis for a reason, right?
It's a crisis for a reason.
Right.
And this creates a huge burden on the families. You know, when mental health services aren't there, when beds aren't there, the families really have to be the shadow mental health system in this state. And families, by and large, want to do that, but they're not really prepared to do this kind of thing. And so often something tragic happens. We work with families, and one of the things I'm really, really grateful to our Missouri Department of Mental Health for is they have invested a little bit of money in some family support and family education so that we can help the family cope and to help. But we can't be the mental health system. We need a good mental health system here in Missouri. Families just can't do that.
Right. And one factor we haven't really talked about here, but we've talked a lot about how things get paid for, is the Parity Act.
Yes.
Could someone explain the Parity Act a little bit and how that works or doesn't work in Missouri, what does work here?
Well, federally, 2 or 3 years ago, actually more than 2 years ago, I suppose, there was a federal act that was passed that said, look, you must provide at least the same level of care for people with serious mental health problems that you do with people with physical problems. You can't say to a family, you have $100,000 in your policy, I can give you unlimited physical health care, but if your child has a serious mental health problem, sorry, you get 5 outpatient visits, you can go to the hospital 3 times, and then that's it. You're either cut off from your insurance or you simply don't have anything left for at least the year's period. That changed when the federal government said, no, that's not acceptable. We must treat mental illnesses like we treat physical illnesses, and they must have the same access to services from a legal standpoint that others do, and that's what parity was about. It's still being implemented across the country. It's still far from perfect, but people are beginning to grasp the idea that they simply can't cut people off from treatment for behavioral health simply because it is a mental illness.
Right.
And what Cindy's group and my group and the provider system are going to be looking for are examples when that appears not to be happening. And when we get those kind of feedback, we'll report those to our friends at the Department of Insurance and federal government that are in charge of monitoring those policies to make sure they're complying with federal parity law.
Sure. I want to bring in a comment we had from the audience. She had called in but wasn't able to stay in the line, but she said, "It's a phenomenal challenge for parents trying to get help for children, but it's also important for patients to want to get better and take treatment seriously." She says, "For an example, an alcoholic receiving a liver transplant, some might think twice about treating them if they knew they live a self-destructive lifestyle." Wonder any reactions to that kind of comment about?
Well, it is correct, of course. You always are a lot more successful if your patient realizes he has a problem.
Exactly.
The thing about a serious mental illness, though, is really, really difficult for young people to realize what's happening to them. And then on top of that is the stigma of admitting that something like that might be happening. And there's tremendous ignorance in the state among all of us, and including patients, who get diagnosed with schizophrenia and they think it's a death sentence.
Right.
So, yeah, I understand exactly what the lady's saying, and yes, young people will resist. The fact that young people are resisting doesn't mean we shouldn't be treating.
Sure.
And people people in Connecticut, Colorado, and other places who are who have seen horrific events when young people don't get the help they need, those individuals realize treatment has to be applied.
Sure. We actually have a caller on the line now as well, Rick from Columbia. Rick, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for calling in today.
Yeah, great show. Yes, I'm a I did in-home family therapy. I'm a LPC contracted with Division of Family Services. It was a
Oh, Rick, are you there? Oh, I think we may have lost Rick. Well, I do have a note on what he was asking about. He was wondering about the issue of universal mental health insurance. He thought it's going to open things up for everyone. I wondered, any thoughts on that and maybe an explanation of what that is?
I frankly do not know.
Cindy.
Yeah, that's a term that's unfamiliar to me. But
okay.
What he might be talking about are the provisions under the Affordable Care Act that provide for parity in mental health coverage in all insurance plans. Also, now with the Affordable Care Act, you can get free screening. You don't have to pay a copay or a deductible. So we hope that will help people get screened and get into treatment. But we still have this issue of stigma. And I'll just show you one example.
Yeah.
I will share something with you that happened in my own family. My brother-in-law was a dairy farmer down in southwest Missouri, and, you know, very independent sort, really a great guy. And he developed, at first he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and later, you know, we began to realize it was schizophrenia. He, in his delusions, would not accept treatment. He was good with treatment for a while, but then the mental health center that was in his community in Ash Grove got closed down because of budget cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So he fell off treatment, became more and more ill, and he, because of stigma and also because he wasn't able to get into care easily, he started using the only treatment that is socially acceptable for a man, especially a farmer in rural Missouri, and that's drinking.
Mm.
And he drank a lot, and eventually it got to the point where the drinking wasn't working. He was having to drink more and more and more. And 3 years ago, he took his own life.
Okay.
This happens a lot. We talk to families every day who their loved one has not been able to get into treatment. You know, they may have a window of time when that loved one is willing. And by golly, treatment needs to be there when they're willing. If you wait longer, they'll become more ill. They may become more resistant. They may have friends that say, you don't need to take that medication. Turn to alcohol, which, you know, in at least 60% of our people with mental illnesses use alcohol to self-medicate, and it only makes things worse. I know we're painting kind of a dire picture here, but it is pretty dire.
Yeah. Well, Keith, go ahead.
You know, Brian, the irony of this whole issue is my budget is about $1.6 billion per year. That's an operating budget. And we have at least $22 million in that budget that we pay for those crisis services on a very short-term basis, 100 cents on the dollar. The state pays the full dollar. If we had expanded Medicaid and those folks would be covered, we would, for the first 2 years now, it would have been three, but for the first 2 years, the federal government would be paying the full 100% from the tax dollars we send, obviously, to the federal government. And even after that, it's only 10%. So my $22 million could leverage a phenomenal amount of care for Missourians. And that's what's such an irony about this process. We have in our control the ability to fix this problem, and we simply are not moving in that direction.
Take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today on Intersection, we're exploring the implications of Missouri's shortage of mental health professionals. Joining me in studio, Keith Schaefer is the director of the Missouri Department of Mental Health. Cindy Keel is the executive director of the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Brent McGinty is the president and CEO of the Missouri Coalition of Community Mental Health Centers. For you and our audience, do you think Fulton State Hospital should be rebuilt? Share your thoughts. Let us know by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersect@kbia. That was my excuse to start talking about that, because we need to before the show ends. Fulton State Hospital, that's a big story. It's a facility that has needed work for quite some time.
Yes.
There is a proposal for $200 million in bonds for construction there. Cindy, why is this needed?
Okay, I've been with NAMI for 23 years now. And it was at least 20 years ago, I heard Keith Schaefer make a presentation on Fulton State Hospital.
Surely
and
I'm not that old.
Oh! And the presentation was around how much that old, outdated facility was costing the state in repairs and utility bills and the outdated design of the hospital 20 years ago. This is not treatment. It has gotten so bad, it is pretty much just warehousing people. You know, I have a lot of respect for the mental health professionals who work there. I know they're doing the best they can, but this facility is like a medieval dungeon.
What are the conditions like?
It's
people
who
haven't been there?
It's horrible.
The condition, remember, first of all, Fulton is the oldest state hospital west of the Mississippi.
Exactly.
Started in 1851 with the death of a governor who killed himself, a guy named Tom Reynolds. Fulton has been a wonderful place for many years. It basically was seen as a sanctuary or an asylum for people who were troubled. But now Fulton serves the most violent, the most troubled people with mental illness who have been sent to us by the courts. It is the state's only maximum security facility. People have tremendous problems with their mental illness, and yet we're putting them in units in which it's a concrete floor, concrete ceiling only 7 feet high, concrete walls. The noise is phenomenally loud. It makes me sick when I go there in terms of just the noise itself. Mm-hmm. Actually, I will tell you, I think our Fulton staff do an absolutely spectacular job given the condition that they're in. But this is not the kind of client that was envisioned when Fulton State Hospital was built. Mm-hmm. This is a much more difficult client, much more dangerous client. It is just a really bad place to try to do the treatment physically, a bad place to try to do the treatment that we're doing now. We absolutely were way beyond the touch point on that. We really have to make changes to Fulton State Hospital. We should have done it 10, 15 years ago. We have to do it now.
I have a guess, but why hasn't it happened yet? Money.
Well, in the last 5 or 6 years, it hasn't happened because the economy's been so bad.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't ask, legitimately, I could not ask for us to make an investment, just like there are a lot of other physical plant investment needs we need here. The other thing I will tell you is during that last 5 or 6 years, we downsized Fulton from 471 beds down to 300 expressly for the reason of trying to get to a level that we think it's affordable. If I'd asked you to rebuild Fulton State Hospital in 2008, I would have asked you for $340 million and roughly 500 beds. So it's a sign of the times. It's also, it's like everything else in mental illness. There are lots of competing pressures with education, roads and bridges, public safety. It's the nature of of our systems.
Sure. And so those other, like you said, we moved around some of the people that are receiving care there, but yes. Now we've still got these very, like I guess, high risk. I mean, very
extremely high risk. Yeah. There are critical public safety issues here. The treatment needs to be the very best there. And actually, I think our staff are extremely good at what they do. But our staff are getting hurt.
Right.
The patients aren't getting hurt so much, but our staff are getting hurt. It is the most dangerous place to work based on workers' comp in Missouri. If you are a staff person there, one in every three of our staff people are going to be seriously hurt and sent to the hospital, whereas all the rest of the state, all other state employees, it's one in 23, and that includes corrections. Mm. So it's a program whose time has come. We've got to make a change.
Right. And so there is a little bit of political debate over the bond issue, and that function to – for the funding? I mean, what are some of the other options if that doesn't...
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I have close friends on both the Republican and the Democratic side, and I don't know of any person in the legislature now who doesn't believe that Fulton State Hospital should be rebuilt. The question is the vehicle used to rebuild that. The governor's recommended that we use a bond strategy in which an appropriation will be placed in a budget, and that appropriation will be paid out over a 25-year period, just like you were buying your home, and we would be building Fulton in that regard. Some people believe that this should be sent to a vote of the people, which will take a lot longer, and I frankly don't have the time left for Fulton State Hospital in terms of its current situation. Some people believe we should just pay for it outright. But the problem is, even this year, there's huge differences between the governor's budget and the legislative budget, and a lot of discussion about what we can afford and what we can't afford. I frankly strongly believe the governor's recommendation on this issue is the right choice to make on rebuilding Fulton.
And I might add, it's not often that my board goes on record, but we voted unanimously as a board to approve and support the Department of Mental Health and the governor's proposal on their method, on their idea on how to move Fulton and the replacement of Fulton forward. That, like I said, doesn't happen often, but it was unanimous, and we fully support that effort.
How would that affect your work in the community mental health centers?
Well, for us, really, this is an issue that it's just morally wrong what's happening there for these individuals, and the safety issues for the staff there are something that we have concern about, and it's just time. It's not effective treatment, and a lot of the folks at Fulton ultimately will come out. A good number of them will come out into the community and recover enough that the courts will intervene and allow them to transition to the community, and we all would be better served by having better treatment at Fulton State Hospital.
Brent can have the biggest impact on Fulton State Hospital if we expand Medicaid, because he can reach young people earlier. They won't deteriorate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They won't get into law enforcement and commit serious crimes, et cetera, and they will never come to me at Fulton State Hospital, and we'll keep the size down. If Brent works effectively, then he's the antidote to a larger Fulton State Hospital.
That's right.
And I admire the fact that the community mental health centers in this state have said Fulton State Hospital is a priority, not because of what we do, but because of what happens if we aren't able to do what we need to do.
Yeah, we're kind of nationally known for our work with the state and our partnerships with the state on transitioning people from these facilities to the community. We're also nationally known for our work with Department of Corrections and linking up services for people coming out of prison. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great, instead of being nationally known for that we're nationally known for having effective and evidence-based practices on the front end versus people coming out on the other side of things? It's time that treatment modality change.
Cindy, you've been dying to get in
Keith
here.
Yeah, as Keith said, you know, the whole system is backwards. We are not investing in early detection and treatment, and we're having to do all these things on the back end. But back to Fulton State Hospital and the population that is now at Fulton State Hospital, by and large, people with serious mental illness are more often the victim of crimes than the perpetrators. Just people who wind up there have been failed by the mental health system, and that's why they're landing there. And, you know, just if you have any compassion at all, regardless of what crime they may have committed, that place, again, is like a medieval dungeon. There's razor wire around the yard at Biggs. This is a prison for sick people. And if we are a compassionate society here in Missouri, we should do better. and we should get rid of that old, outdated building and bring ourselves more up to the compassionate care that we know helps people recover.
So if something were not, if it didn't happen in the legislature for some reason this year, what might be a way to make this happen otherwise?
I have no clue. Yeah, interestingly, because I've spent my life figuring out alternatives, but I have no clue what we're going to do if we don't start funding Fulton State Hospital. It is beyond the tipping point. You can't simply dump. We have delayed, by the way, $73 million worth of capital maintenance improvements for that facility because it's just the wrong facility. Laid out wrong, long, narrow hallways, very dangerous place. We've got to change it. So I don't know what the answer will be if we don't do this.
One thing I wanted to just jump back to before we end the show here in a few minutes is the idea of getting to these rural communities. I guess we didn't really – you mentioned, Brent, the different places that your organization, the community health centers, are located in the state. But what are some of the areas that are – again, a top of the list that need higher priority, where there's a lot of care or care that's missed in Missouri? What regions, I guess, of the state is there need?
Yeah, I think Keith touched on it briefly, but there's not an area of the state that doesn't have need. Mm-hmm. Rural areas in particular, sure. There are some parts of this state and the rural parts that are really suffering. Also, like Keith said, we've got to start thinking about different ways of delivering care. Mm-hmm. Telepsychiatry mm-hmm. is one that has a lot of providers are really exploring and adding some capacity. We've got a broadband initiative where all of our community mental health centers are now linked with real good broadband capability so we can do some treatment that way. And that seems to be very successful and surprisingly seems to work very well.
And that's been something in physical health, telemedicine they're talking about. So, again, that may be another opportunity to kind of work together, talking about earlier in the show.
Absolutely.
You guys at MU, by the way, are very good at this. People like John Loriella and others here are really looking at the telepsychiatry. We absolutely are going to have – we're going to have to realize that primary care docs are going to get hit with a lot of this stuff, including behavioral health. They need mm-hmm. consult. They need to be able to call somebody and say, I got this guy, and I don't really know what to do with him, and I need help. Here are his symptoms. What's the right medicine, that kind of stuff. We don't have to have the psychiatrist in Licking, Missouri. He's not going to live there. But we do have to have the mm-hmm. primary care physician in Licking have access to a psychiatrist someplace to get good consult. Mm-hmm.
Is this a viable long-term solution, I guess, telemedicine?
Part of it. It's not the only one, but it's part of it.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about it. The system's kind of maxed out everywhere at the moment, though, right? So it's not like the guy in Kansas City has time for the person in Licking.
More resources in Kansas City, Springfield, St. Louis, but even they have shortages. And you can imagine in southeast Missouri, northeast Missouri particularly, upper central Missouri, major shortages.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to stop it there, actually. That's all the time we do have for today. We could talk, I'm sure, for hours more on this topic. Maybe we will someday. But that is all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guest, Keith Schaefer, the director of the Missouri Department of Mental Health, Cindy Keel, the executive director of the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Brent McGinty, the president and CEO of the Missouri Coalition of Community Mental Health Centers. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersections produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware and Casey Morrell. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.